From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. If North Carolina policymakers want to proceed with legalizing dental therapy, it might help to learn how another state has addressed the issue. We'll get the Florida perspective. Some state lawmakers want to change rules linked to public school discipline in North Carolina. You'll learn why their proposals generated debate on the state house floor. A new state law will help more small businesses offer health insurance through something called association health plans. We'll share details. And we'll examine protesters' concerns about Governor Roy Cooper's energy plan. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Helping patients, that of course is what every doctor strives to do. But what does a doctor do when or if a state law prevents that? Well, in North Carolina, one doctor, a Winston-Salem surgeon, actually is suing the state of North Carolina. And now the John Locke Foundation has filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, in the case called Singh versus North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. John Gazay is the director of legal studies for the Locke Foundation. He wrote this brief, filed in early October, in the Wake County Superior Court. He's here to talk about what it all means. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
Why is the John Locke Foundation involved in a court case in North Carolina?
What's at stake in this case is a law referred to as a Certificate of Need law. Under that law, hospitals and other healthcare providers for a wide range of services, including in this case, MRIs, have to obtain a certificate of need from the state before they're allowed to provide those services. So in Dr. Singh's case, he can't even acquire an MRI machine without first obtaining a certificate of need. At the time he filed the complaint last year, there were no certificates of needs available. So he had no option of obtaining an MRI to use in his practice under any circumstances.
He works out of Forsyth County. He's a surgeon there and trying to serve his patients. And he has actually been a guest here on Carolina Journal Radio. And in his case, he says, hey, I'm trying to help my patients. And in what I do as being a surgeon, sometimes multiple scans are necessary to diagnose and treat a patient. He also says he could do this at a lower cost. My point, John, is that this sounds like it makes common sense. Why would the state of North Carolina believe that state bureaucrats would decide, rather than Dr. Singh, as to what his patients need?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, part of it is simply that an awful lot of people in government and people even out of government think that government knows best and think that things like healthcare will be provided better and more cheaply under some kind of centralized control. But there's more to it than that. It used to be in the 70s that a couple federal programs were raising the cost of healthcare to the federal government. We had a cost-plus reimbursement system that was in place for Medicare and Medicaid. That meant that the more services a doctor or a hospital provided, the more money they made and the more the state had to pay for it. And then to deal with that in sort of a ham-fisted way, the federal government passed a law that actually required states to have certificate of need laws if they wanted to continue receiving funds to reimburse Medicare and Medicaid patients. So at the time this current law was passed in 1978, there was a rationale, and that was it. But what happened in the 80s was Congress for once actually realized it had made a mistake and changed both of those laws. They stopped reimbursing on a cost-plus basis and moved to a fixed fee for per service model, and they also repealed the law that required states to have con laws. At that point, some states, the sensible states, repealed their con laws and went back to letting doctors and hospitals provide the services that they thought their patients needed. that didn't happen in North Carolina. Our law is still on the books and it's still being enforced.
John, let's talk a little bit more about what is in your friend of the court brief in this case. Dr. Singh contends in his lawsuit that the certificate of need law related to MRIs is unconstitutional. What do you write about that?
Well, we say that he's right. It is unconstitutional. In his brief, which was written, for the record, I should say, by the Institute for Justice, they are providing pro bono legal services for him. They charged the state with three counts of constitutional violations. It violates the Due Process Clause. It violates the Exclusive Emoluments Clause. It violates the Anti-Monopoly Clause. And it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the North Carolina State Constitution. We agree with all three of those. It does violate those provisions of the North Carolina Constitution.
Does that suggest then, John, that Dr. Singh is likely to prevail in his case?
Well, we certainly hope so. The problem we've got here in North Carolina and throughout the country is what's called tiers of scrutiny doctrine. The courts have taken the position over the years, and it's the law here as in many states, that different kinds of rights get different levels of protection. There's nothing in the North Carolina Constitution that says that or in the U.S. Constitution, but that's what the courts say. And in this case, this has been treated in the past as an economic regulation, and economic regulations get the lowest level of scrutiny, what's called rational basis scrutiny. What that means is if the court can find any possible rational basis for a law, it will uphold it. In this case, with certificate of need laws, that's already happened. In 2010, the Court of Appeals upheld the con law to a constitutional challenge because it said that the findings of fact that were appended to the law when it was passed in 1978 and amended in 1988, those findings of fact were sufficient to provide a rational basis, even though they violate common sense and basic economics, because those findings of fact say that by restricting the supply of medical services, we can reduce the cost and improve the accessibility.
That seems to turn economics on its head.
It absolutely turns economics on its head. Arguably, in the 1970s, there was a rationale for doing that because of these perverse federal laws, but those laws are gone. At the present time, there's no possible justification for making such an irrational assumption. And one of the things we argue in our brief is that the court shouldn't simply defer to the legislature on this. It's got to take a look at the facts of the matter. And we've attached as an appendix a long list of studies, all of which were published since the Court of Appeals handed down that decision in 2010, dozens of them, all of which find that, just as you would expect, in states with con laws, healthcare, the services covered by con laws cost more, they're harder to obtain, there's fewer of them. And we think the court needs to take that into consideration.
John, as you studied this case and Dr. Singh's assertions in his lawsuits, and then as you reviewed the North Carolina Constitution and did your research, what did you come away with believing is the strongest component of the case to say that Dr. Singh is being unfairly kept from providing MRI scans to his patients?
I think his strongest argument is his argument under the North Carolina State Constitution's Anti-Monopoly Clause. That clause was originally, and I've written a paper about this, that clause was originally added to the state constitution in 1776 for the specific purpose of preventing the awarding of or the grant of exclusive privileges to individuals or groups. That's what we have here. It's exactly the kind of monopoly that the clause was written to prevent, and it's perfectly on point. I think he should prevail on that, if nothing else.
Now, what happens to this case from here? You filed the brief in the last day of September. What happens? When will it be heard?
The schedule right now calls for a hearing the week of October 21st. At some point after that, hopefully not too long after that, the court will make a decision whether to dismiss the case or not. Whatever the court does, I'm sure the other side will appeal. So I think this case is either going to go forward in the Superior Court or it's going up to the Court of Appeals.
And John, when you say the other side, you're talking about the state of North Carolina, because the case is against the Department of Health and Human Services.
That's right.
Right. And there are other organizations in addition to the John Locke Foundation. National organizations have taken an interest in North Carolina's certificate of need laws. Why?
Because this is a problem all across the country. There's still con laws in place in 35 states. I believe that's the number. everywhere they're there, they're harming the public, they're raising costs, they're reducing accessibility, and they're violating people's rights. What happens in North Carolina is going to be important all over the country.
John, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If North Carolina wants to move forward with making dental therapy available in the state, it will be helpful to look at how that process has played out in other states. Joining us now with insight on that topic is Sal Nuzzo. He is Vice President for Policy at the James Madison Institute in Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you in Florida have actually gone through this process of trying to make dental therapy a reality. Before we get into how it's played out, why was this seen as something that would be a good idea?
Well, in Florida, we have a very specific vision for market-based healthcare reforms. I mean, we all know that the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare was a failure, and it's kind of relegated to the states to improve healthcare access and healthcare quality. In Florida, as we were doing some research, we uncovered some rather significant shortages of oral healthcare practitioners throughout the state. And so there were things that we were looking at in other areas of healthcare, and we were approached by some folks in the state who had said, this is a big problem. What can be brought to bear on the policy side? And so we began to look at what other states were doing. We came across the state of Minnesota, which has a pretty well-established program for dental therapy and advanced dental therapy. And we began to see that a number of states had begun to implement the policy. So last year in 2018, we did a research study and we began the process of working with policymakers on exploring this. It continued into the 2019 legislative session, and it's an ongoing debate.
As a reminder for people who are new to this, how is dental therapy different than what we know about going to the dentist and meeting with the dentist?
Sure. The best analogy to make is it's a little bit more expansive than a dental hygienist, but less expansive than a dentist. And so whereas a dentist in many situations can perform somewhere upwards of 450 to 500 procedures, depending on the state and the regulatory system, dental therapists are in the kind of 75 to 125 procedures. So routine care and maintenance, filling cavities, working with patients on a more regular basis to kind of make oral care a more consistent part of their routine. It lowers healthcare costs in two ways. One is it's, you know, the providers are less expensive. And secondly, it also kind of creates a system where people are taking more responsibility for oral care, thus limiting the need for more expensive procedures down the road.
More access, lower costs. Sounds like a great idea. When you decided to put this out there, everyone jumped on board and said, yes, let's do it, right?
Isn't that always the case in policy? Wish that it were. Inevitably, anytime you talk about an idea for structural or systemic change in an area so entrenched like healthcare, you're going to butt up against kind of the special interests that kind of are that benefit off of the existing regulatory system. And so, as was the case in Minnesota and about seven or eight other states that have implemented this, they've had to do battle with the state chapter of the American Dental Association, who represents dentists, who, you know, when you talk with dentists on the ground, you generally get a supportive attitude, but the trade association kind of sees things another way.
Do we get a sense of why?
It's a really good question, and I've sat down with them, as we've gone through the policy debate over the last couple of years, and they bring out arguments that just don't hold water. They say it won't actually help. Well, the research and both anecdotal and quantifiable statistics show that it does. They say people with high school degrees will be pulling teeth. Well, that's just kind of a scare tactic, and they say some other things that just that don't make any sense when you unpack the reality of the policy. So the only conclusion that, you know, we can come to is that they're a trade association and a special interest that sees this as a threat to their existing members, where in reality, it's exactly the opposite. And those states that have implemented the policy have kind of proven that out.
We are chatting with Sal Nuzzo, who is Vice President for Policy at the James Madison Institute. As you've chatted with other folks who are not the dentists, who would see perhaps their own ox gored, what's been the response among other folks? Do they say, yeah, this sounds like a great idea?
Well, and that's pretty much been the overall response. This is a great idea. It will provide access to patients for oral care, which has traditionally been one of the tougher kind of areas of healthcare to get people into a chair in. And one of the reasons is that it's kind of scary. Folks do not really like going to a dentist. So the coalition that we put together was made up of dental hygienists, family care physicians, interest groups, trade associations, all of whom are active in healthcare and healthcare policy, and all of whom, with the exception of, you know, the one existing association, the Dental Association, all of whom are in favor of the program.
One thing that I have heard as a layman in this is that dental care and oral hygiene are incredibly important for overall healthcare. Is that the sense that you're getting from the people in other parts of the healthcare system, that if we can make this better, that will make our lives easier dealing with so many other things?
100%. And that's why we've actually had folks in primary care services come on board to the coalition. And there's a tragic case that kind of lays all this out. A number of years back, a young, I believe he was 11 or 12 years old, boy in Maryland contracted a tooth infection, something that a simple over-the-counter or prescription antibiotic would have knocked out. He did not have access to a dentist. He was the son of a single working mom, and the infection eventually spread to his brain. By the time he was admitted to the ER, he was gone within a day or two. And so at the extreme, you have oral care impacting somebody's life. And in the less extreme, it oral care is kind of the gateway to overall physical care.
In the brief time that we have left, if North Carolina is going to get on this path of pursuing dental therapy, what should the folks pushing for it expect?
Expect that it will be a multi-year debate and kind of battle. Anything that's truly transformative is going to take a period of time. I would expect to gain success, build a great and broad coalition of folks from across healthcare, from across parent groups, from across stakeholder groups as well. Get grassroots support for this and let it build up from the bottom up, and policymakers will listen.
Do you get a sense, based on what's happened in other states, that your own state, Florida, eventually North Carolina, other states that haven't even thought about this, will have dental therapy one day?
I believe so. And I think we're in kind of the early adopter stage of any kind of innovation. Minnesota and Alaska were really the first two states to kind of bring this on, even though it's been in practice in other countries for many years. So you've got those first handful of states that have kind of embraced it. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to begin to see a groundswell of support for this that'll kind of topple a few other states in the policy arena on this. And then eventually, I think it'll be a kind of a 50-state solution.
One person who will watch with interest as this plays out is Sal Nuzzo. He is vice president for policy at the James Madison Institute in Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Issues surrounding school discipline recently generated debate on the state House floor. Republican Representative Jeffrey Elmore defended a bill. It would require local school systems to establish discipline standards and share them with the state.
What this bill actually does is create a level of transparency where all these discipline plans will be submitted to DPI, where they can be reviewed. You can see if there's outliers in the discipline plans that are being submitted, that one particular LEA on a particular issue is way out here, and all 114 others are not, to where you can see that in the actual policies. So even though it seems like there's a certain level of flexibility. With the flexibility is coming a higher level of transparency with this, to where we can actually analyze what is going on with the discipline plans across the state, to where we can see if there's problems or not.
Democratic Representative Kelly Alexander was among those objecting to one piece of the bill. It would end certain exemptions from punishment.
We are perhaps venturing into an area with long-term suspension on something as open to interpretation as dress that we might want to be very careful about. I know that in a number of circumstances, you have some cultural differences as to what constitutes acceptable dress. You have some stylistic differences. We come up with conflicts all the time between interpretations of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable.
Republican Representative Harry Warren responded to the complaints.
We talk about local control being dictated to by the state legislature. Well, if you read the bill, on page 1, lines 10 through 11 says, local boards of education in consultation with teachers, school-based administrators, parents, and local law enforcement agencies shall adopt. The way I read that means there's 115 LEAs that'll determine locally, not by us, but locally, what their parameters for behavior and discipline will be. It would seem to me that we are simply requiring local boards of education to come up with a code of behavior that is relevant to their individual LEA, and every stakeholder is involved. Then the bill goes on to require them to make sure that everybody is aware of what that code is.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent debate about changes to state school discipline rules. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Small business owners in North Carolina have a new option for providing health insurance. A new state law permits association health plans. They allow small businesses to band together as larger units to be treated like big companies when purchasing health coverage. Republican State Senator Joyce Kravick explains why lawmakers wanted to address the issue.
As we travel around as legislators and we talk with our constituents, small business owners every day tell us the difficulties of offering health care coverage to their employees. Large businesses have been able to take advantage of that for a long time. This bill just opens it up for small businesses to be able to have the same advantages that large businesses currently enjoy.
Kravick says most insurance rules and mandates will remain in place.
Insurance agencies and the insurance commissioner is in charge of all of the regulations. They will remain the same. This just changes who is able to take advantage of that opportunity.
Republican State Representative Kyle Hall explained his support for association health plans.
For me, this started off with speaking to my constituents back at home. As a realtor, I see in our small real estate firm, some of our agents simply cannot afford to go out on their own and purchase health insurance. I've heard it from plumber in Walnut Cove, North Carolina. I've heard it from a coffee shop owner in Pilot Mountain. And I've heard it from farmers in Lawsonville, North Carolina. It goes across the small business spectrum.
Democratic Representative Brian Turner joined colleagues in support of association health plans.
As a realtor, I know that this has been something that's been talked about at my firm for a number of years. It really addresses a number of the concerns that folks have had with these types of plans in the past. These plans will have to abide by some strong solvency standards. They're going to have to cover pre-existing conditions. They're going to be regulated by the Department of Insurance. And essentially, they're going to operate as large employers under North Carolina law and still have coverage requirements and rules and regulations to abide by. In large part, the market and the associations will dictate what these plans cover. Though, given what we've got on the market today, it's most likely that these are going to cover a lot of the basics, like prescription drugs, mental health, maternity care, things like that. We expect to see those in most of those plans. And then there are also a number of federal health benefit mandates that will apply to these plans. And they'll be subject to the same 57 requirements that the state also mandates here in North Carolina. So we're hoping that as these things move forward, you'll see the benefit of it across the state. And at the end of the day, I just really want to remind folks that these plans are going to be offered by associations. And these associations are there to work for the benefit of the members. And I expect that the plans that we will see will reflect that.
Republican Representative Josh Dobson placed the association health plans in context. Lawmakers approved them in the Small Business Health Care Act.
Small Business Health Care Act provides a tool to our small businesses to combat the rising cost of health care under the Affordable Care Act and seek lower cost coverage options for their employees. Under this bill, organizations like the North Carolina Chamber, North Carolina Retail Merchants Association, the North Carolina Realtors, North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association, all are in support of the bill, and among many others, could offer high-quality health coverage to their employer members at an affordable cost. These organizations represent hundreds of thousands of small businesses, independent contractors, and employers who reside in all 100 counties throughout this state.
Lawmakers highlighted support from the business community. Greg Adams and his family own two grocery stores in Lee County. Adams also serves as chairman for the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association.
With the tight job market we have in North Carolina, it's difficult to recruit and retain employees without providing benefits like health insurance. As an independent grocery store owner, our company's health insurance costs have gone up tremendously over the last few years. Currently, the cost of health insurance and individual health insurance policies in North Carolina's small group market is more than many independent retailers can afford. When our association of board of directors meet, the cost of health insurance and the plea for legislative relief is the number one issue we discuss. This comes from all kinds of retailers like bookstores, clothing stores, convenience stores, et cetera, et cetera. The Small Business Health Care Act, it will help level the playing field for businesses like mine and larger retailers and other larger employers, allowing my business to join together with other retailers to have the opportunity to purchase the same insurance that large businesses can purchase seems only fair to me. We all often hear that small business is the backbone of North Carolina, and I can think of no other better way to help small business. I'm on the board for the Piggly Wiggly stores for our groups, and this is the number one thing we talk about. I'm also on the board for the Carolina Food Industry Council, and at the board meetings with all the other businesses, it's the same thing.
Richard Green is executive director for the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild.
We have a lot of small business people who employ between 5 and 25 people. Their biggest issue, beyond getting more sales, of course, is being able to attract employees and be able to retain them and be able to provide a decent living, which includes health care. I want to thank the legislators for the hard work on this bill. It will be a big boom to our industry, as with all the other retailers and small businesses throughout the state. This is a very critical piece to our business in helping us control our costs.
Wendy Harris of Fayetteville owns a real estate company. She also serves as legislative chair for North Carolina Realtors.
Our members need an option for association health plans for affordable, quality, and accessible health care coverage. As a business owner, as a working business owner, I manage employees and independent contractors. Not one of my team can afford health insurance. Personally, my own grandfathered health insurance plan is being done away with at the end of this year. I have gladly paid 30% increases of my health insurance plan for the last 17 years, and now I am faced with a 300 to 400% increase of my own plan with higher deductibles and lower standards of service. This is very personal to me. As our team, as our realtor team has traveled around the state this year from Murphy to Manio, the number one thing we have heard is stories of the challenges and hard choices our members are facing because of the rising costs of coverage. We've heard about how costs have risen every year and how others have also had previously grandfathered plans that are no longer available. We've heard from people who had to make the unconscionable choice of paying for their health insurance or paying their mortgage. And now, right now, we have 6,000 realtors who are uninsured because they no longer can make that choice. They have to have a home for their families. Association health plan coverage is the only viable option that will close this gap in the market for these citizens. Our future health and well-being depends on the success of this bill. We still have work ahead of us. We need to develop plans which best meet our members' needs. We're committed to establishing plans that provide the highest quality coverage for an affordable price.
You've been listening to supporters touting North Carolina's recently enacted Small Business Health Care Act. It will help those small businesses band together for association health plans. Those plans will provide more affordable health care options for small business employees. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Governor Roy Cooper faced protesters at a recent meeting of what's called the Climate Change Interagency Council. That's really just a fancy name for the state panel that's been tasked with meeting the governor's goal of transitioning North Carolina to what he calls a clean energy economy. So what does that really mean? Don Vandervaart has an answer for that. He is the senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation, also the former secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality under Governor Pat McCrory. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the governor had his big meeting, and there were protesters outside. Now, one would just in general think that environmentalists would be with the governor's plan to go to a clean energy economy. So what were the protesters upset with the governor about?
Well, as best I can tell, there were a number of issues, and you know, some of them had to do with the governor's apparent support for expanded use of natural gas, which new research has indicated may, in fact, not be as good for preventing global warming as previously thought. Then there were also concerns about the continued manufacturing, the expanded manufacturing of wood pellets for use in, especially in Europe, for combustion under the guise of it being carbon neutral, which most scientists would disagree with. And then, of course, they wanted more solar and more wind. And it's not clear who wants more of that. They both say they want more.
Don, the governor's plan essentially calls for two things. He says he wants to modernize the electric grid, and also he wants to reduce our use of fossil fuel energy. So that on its face sounds like, hey, good ideas, but what do you say?
That's actually a bit of an oxymoron. What he wants to modernize the grid for is to allow more solar, more intermittent sources, which are difficult to integrate. And right now we're sort of at the limit of that. So he wants to improve the grid so that that would accommodate more solar. But that's essentially saying we want more natural gas because you can't have solar power added onto your grid without having the requisite backup natural gas combustion turbines. And that's simply the fact. So if you want more more solar, you want more natural gas. And again, I think I'm a little sympathetic to the protesters. The increased use of natural gas now, according to new research coming out of both Cornell and Duke here in North Carolina, indicates that the various steps of natural gas production and transportation leads to significant emissions of methane, the primary component of natural gas. Methane, in turn, is a very powerful greenhouse gas, much more powerful than CO2. And these researchers opine that the increased use of natural gas, in fact, is tantamount to adding a coal-fired unit. There is a disagreement here. The Department of Environmental Quality uses older numbers, an older approach. You would agree with Cornell and with the Duke professor if you believe the climate change crisis, if you will, is in the next 20 years more important, or you would agree with the Department of Environmental Quality if you think it's much, much longer than that. And I think that was a major part of the protest.
Don, as we learn more and more and more research is done into not just fossil fuels, which we know a lot about, but also these so-called renewable sources that have become so popular, not only with the public, but also in public policy in terms of subsidies, tax credits, et cetera. Right. But we seem to be learning that to every type of energy source, there are pros and there are cons. There is really no panacea.
Certainly that's true with intermittent sources like solar and wind. The problems we're facing, that Duke is facing, in integrating these intermittent sources is going to lead to a very costly fix, that is, to modernize the grid. What we are missing, I think, is the very important component of nuclear power. And we need to, before we spend more money on solar and wind, we need to very seriously talk about, number one, to incentivize the continued use of our existing nuclear plants, and we need to have the conversation about building new nuclear plants.
One would think that people who identify themselves as environmentalists and are so concerned about greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, et cetera, that they would love nuclear power because it is zero emissions, but most of them don't. But you say that in the scientific community, it's a different view.
If you look at the serious, what I think, serious environmentalists, you'll see support for nuclear power. The question you raise is a very good one, which is, on the one hand, you hear people wanting more solar, which means more natural gas. And I'm arguing, and others are arguing, for more nuclear. Let's consider this. What if we add a 30% increase in our load due to having everyone drive electric vehicles, something that Governor Cooper very much says he wants? Under the current grid and under the current policies, that 30% increase is going to be met with primarily natural gas. So you'll see an increase in the amount of greenhouse gases being emitted. For a shift to electric vehicles, that Governor Cooper and others claim is actually going to benefit our environment. On the other hand, if we put that off and concentrate on keeping our nuclear plants going, getting them relicensed, and beginning construction on new nuclear, you're going to ultimately lead to a place where electric vehicles might make sense.
I think the discussion of EVs is really interesting because you will hear some supporters say, look, you know, there's nothing coming out of the tailpipe. But you have written about this. What about the other side of that?
Well, right. I mean, I think any serious adult knows that you're simply shifting the emissions from the tailpipe to a nearby steam station, whether it's a coal-fired steam station or a natural gas plant. Those emissions are coming out. And I think what's important to remember is that these units, these electric vehicles, aren't any more efficient than our gasoline engines. And we really need to go slowly before we jump into a massive nationwide incentive program to have us drive those vehicles.
We often talk about the stakeholders in different areas of public policy. The big stakeholder, that would be those of us who have to pay electric bills, pretty much everybody, we don't get talked about a whole lot. And so I'd like to get your thoughts in terms of energy policy about the differences in these types of sources and what they cost and ultimately the impact on that electric bill that comes in the mail or that you pay through your bank draft once a month.
It is so true that most of the so-called stakeholders are special interest groups. There is very little representation of the ratepayer as such. And the kind of sources we're talking right now, the cheapest electricity on our grid is existing nuclear plants. That's the cheapest there is. That's what Duke dispatches first. But so often when we talk about solar, they neglect the costs of the natural gas plant that has to come with the solar fields. And those costs combined are very high indeed. We're seeing our rates go up, and recently Duke just asked to increase their rates, much of which is caused by the renewable energy increase.
We've been talking with Don Vandervaart. It's a fascinating subject. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. We appreciate you listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.